super international finance. We were in Zurich last time.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Good morning. Thank you for joining us this morning to discuss creative solutions for economic recovery in conflict-affected areas. My name is Raymond Gilpin, and I direct the USIP's Economies and Conflict Center of Innovation. As most of you know, the United States Institute of Peace is an independent, nonpartisan institution established by the U.S. Congress to help prevent and resolve violent international conflicts, to promote post-conflict stability and development, and to increase conflict management capacity, tools, and intellectual capital worldwide. I invite you to visit our website for more information, and there's some useful material outside on the table, and please feel free to take them to learn more about what we do, why we do it, with whom we do it, where we do it, and how we do it. The Center for Economies and Conflict seeks to analyze economic relationships during all stages of conflict, pre, during, and post. And we aim to collate sound practices and also design appropriate capacity building and reach back tools. Also, as a center of innovation, our work is cross-cutting, and it relates to the influence of economic policy, economic activities, and economic actors across the conflict spectrum. You would agree with me that economic recovery is a crucial component of stabilization in conflict-affected states. In addition to generating income, creating employment, and fostering human security, the processes leading to economic recovery, such as policy reform, institutional strengthening, and investment in infrastructure and technology, also contribute to addressing some of the underlying causes of conflict in these areas. Furthermore, in our current climate of complex emergencies, increasingly urgent priorities, and constrained resources, there is an acute need for creative solutions that deliver comprehensive and sustainable outcomes. These issues were echoed in a speech delivered by World Bank President Bob Zelig earlier this week, in which he captured a challenge for economic statecraft. I believe it's on the web, it's on the World Bank website. I encourage you to read it. It's very engaging and in many ways imaginative. He shares our concern for an innovative approach to for economic recovery, one that is, as I mentioned earlier, both comprehensive and that delivers lasting results. This morning, we're very privileged to have a very distinguished panel to lead our discussions. We have their detailed bios on the table outside, so my introductions of them will be very brief. Our first speaker will be Ambassador David Litt, who is the Executive Director of the Center for Stabilization and Economic Reconstruction in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He's a former U.S. Ambassador to the United Arab Emirates. He has a very stellar Foreign Service career, and he was the third-ranking officer in the U.S. Embassy in Iraq between 2005 and 2006. Before joining the center in North Carolina, he was director for international liaison at the George C. Marshall European Center for Security Studies in Garmisch, Germany. Ambassador Litt will be followed by Ms. Obiageli Ezekwesili. She is vice president for the Africa region at the World Bank. Prior to assuming that position, she held a number of very senior government and ministerial positions in her country, Nigeria, where she earned the distinction of being named as one of the Gang of Four reformers in that country. One hot afternoon in 2005, I observed Obi at work in her office in Abuja, and it became very, very readily apparent how she earned the nickname Madame Due Process, because she's not just very by the book, but she's very stern and she makes things happen. We're very privileged to have you here this morning, Obi. Our third speaker would be Mr. Francis Skrobiszewski. He's Senior Executive Advisor at Monolith Capital Management. He's an accomplished professional, but over the past two decades, he has pioneered innovative private sector solutions for investment and financial intermediation in high-risk environments like conflict-affected states. Among the most notable are his enterprise funds, which he has recently been applying to fragile and conflict-affected states. So we're very looking forward to his presentation this morning, which will have a private sector slant. Ambassador Litt would lead off with an overview of economic challenges in conflict-affected states, and he'll also discuss opportunities for bilateral intervention and international coordination. He will be followed by Obi and Francis, who will give us World Bank and private sector perspectives, respectively. Each speaker will speak for about 15 to 20 minutes, and following which we would have what I hope would be a very interactive question-answer session. Before inviting Ambassador Litt to the podium, I'd like to make a couple of announcements. Firstly, the Q&A session would be conducted under the Chatham House rule as revised in 2002. You may use the information you hear here, citing the Institute, of course, but the affiliation, so the identity of the participant may not be divulged. Secondly, I'd like you to join me in what I fondly refer to as the silencing of the cell phones routine. This is not just a courtesy to our speakers, but it does interfere with a lot of the high-tech equipment that we have here. And so if you would, for the next 90 minutes, please silence your cell phones so that we will have a very an uninterrupted and very productive session. With that, please join me in welcoming our first speaker, Ambassador David Litt.
Thank you very much, Raymond, for that very generous introduction. My presentation this morning, you'll see our title here, Organizing for Success, is a bit tongue-in-cheek. I would say that organizing for success is to economic recovery as dressing for success is to salesmanship. It is an important part, but certainly not the entire part of the story. Truth in lending, I am not an economist. I am not a scholar. I am not an expert in economic development. I'm just a poor foreign service officer who has had the great fortune of serving in a lot of very difficult places. I would say that as we discuss post-conflict environments, this is what I dragged out of my brain of the kinds of environments that we are talking about. One can list many more depending on how far back into history one wants to go, but all of them really are characterized, I think, by some form of international intervention as a common denominator. What I would speak with you today about is what are some of the characteristics of this post-conflict environment? What are the immediate challenges that all of us in the international community face? What are some of the keys to success, if you will, in international operations in a post-conflict scenario? And then I would discuss some of the organizational solutions very, very briefly and rapidly, and a few measures of success that I would throw out to you for your consideration as to whether we're on the right track or not. So to run fairly quickly through this, some of the common elements of post-conflict environments I have listed here, and I started with those that have an impact directly on the individual, working down the ladder to those that have an impact, a systemic impact, societal impact, macroeconomic impact. I would draw your attention to the second point. As we see when citizens, individuals in post-conflict or post-disaster environments faced with despair, hopelessness, betrayal, hunger, and so, tend to retrench themselves and pull out of any participation they may have had in their society, in their economy, in their political system before. There is a almost total lack of transparency in the normal operations of the society and economy, and certainly no sense of accountability in a very chaotic atmosphere. Criminality on the rise, everything from looting to theft to highway robbery to trafficking, corruption, other forms of economic crimes. Highway robbery we saw in Afghanistan following the evacuation of Soviet troops something so serious as to lead to the eventual embracing of the Taliban in the second half of the 1990s. Fragile institutions, weak or non-existent capacity, and we see a resurgence, let's say, of certain authority structures or even new authority structures coming to the fore, whether they are tribal groups or sub-elements of ethnic groups, warlords, criminal gangs, and the like. Infrastructure has been degraded or destroyed, and of course there is a strong impact on any of the economic networks that had existed heretofore, disrupted markets, unemployment or underemployment, and either a flight of capital or a shyness of capital, as some would say capital is a coward. Some of the immediate challenges we see on the ground, therefore, evidently humanitarian relief, whether it's the provision of food or water, shelter, immediate medical care, a minimum of security, of course. But I would point to the urgency of trying to reestablish a psychology of hope on the ground among desperate peoples. Without that psychology of hope, without individuals perceiving that around the corner there is the hope for a better life for themselves, for their families, for their communities, for their villages, their towns and cities, and etc., I would argue that you will never have any strong form of economic recovery or the establishment of a political authority. And I would add to this the importance of reestablishing or establishing a legitimate indigenous authority in the affected nation. Of course, this begs the question as to who decides what is legitimate. We saw this problem in Iraq, of course, in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq, and even afterwards, a battle, if you will, between what is the legitimacy of expatriate groups who come from London or the United States or elsewhere in Europe versus those leaders, indigenous leaders, who happen to remain in Iraq, who perhaps have legitimacy of some of the people, and so on. That form of who decides who is legitimate. And then how quickly does one transfer legitimate authority? Again, a source of a great deal of debate in the Iraq scenario. Should the occupying authority hand over power very, very quickly in a matter of weeks or months, or have a much more deliberate process in which stability is one tries to maintain a sense of stability first. Why is the establishment of an indigenous authority so important for economic recovery? I would say that it has to do with the fact that economic recovery depends on, in the medium term as well as the long term, local control over infrastructure and industry of any sort, whether it's a traditionally defined industry or agricultural industry, and so on. Political reconciliation is a function of control over resources. Of course, something that we are seeing in Iraq today, the inability of the various ethnic religious groups to come to any kind of consensus, political consensus, because of the issue of control over the production and distribution of oil and its income. And then finally, of course, any absence of legitimate indigenous authority, we will see the growth of extremist ideologies and practices, the growth of terrorism, the growth of unwanted external intervention, and the like. So therefore, hence the importance, I would argue, of very quickly trying to establish indigenous authorities. Key areas of concern for international intervention, I would argue that in post-conflict scenarios, pretty much whatever the country or whatever the impact has been, technical solutions, technical competencies, resources around the globe are available. The issue is, who is going to provide them? How will it be provided? And when will they come to the rescue, if you will? We find in post-conflict scenarios a wide variety of international actors rush to the scene, are present in post-conflict front lines, battlefields, or even in neighboring countries, and we see the phenomenon of a series of cultural clashes among these international actors, whether they are militaries, foreign embassies, civilian government organizations of one kind or another, NGOs, international organizations, commercial organizations, companies, and the like. So the first issue is, how are we going to organize ourselves given this plethora of international actors all wanting to come to do some help? This applies whether we're talking about organization within one nation, which is what my institute, the Center for Stabilization and Economic Recovery, is working on, or whether we are talking about organization across nations, the United States, Great Britain, France, Italy, Germany, and so on, or between individual nations and supranational organizations, be they NATO or ECOWAS or any of the UN family of organizations, UNDP, World Food Program, and so on. And then between the public sector interveners and private sector interveners. So how are we going to organize ourselves? The second issue is, how do we coordinate or deconflict our various decision cycles? Each of these actors arrives on the battlefield bringing its own authorities, its own expertise, its own resources. Each will assess the problems as they see it, and of course according to the goods and services that that organization might wish to deliver. Each organization will assign its own priorities, and each will have its own concepts and requirements for coordination with the others, or not. Some do not want to coordinate with others. So how do we reconcile these various decision cycles? There is a natural tension between the delivery, immediate delivery of goods and services directly to the affected individuals, what I call giving the man a fish and feeding him for a day, or delivering an institutional capacity development, teaching a man how to fish and feeding him for life. We saw this tension again in Iraq between some in USAID and some in the military. It is evident that you need some measure of both. You can't do one only to the exclusion of the other, but it's how you divide up your resources and human as well as financial in order to get both of those effects delivered to the affected people. And then finally, there is a dynamic that develops between a robust international donor presence and the sovereignty of the victim nation, who believes very deeply in the need to be the decision makers for what's going on in their country. Of course, we saw this again in the during the era of the CPA and Jerry Bremer, where that kind of dynamic between this robust foreign presence and a weaker government authority, as well as in the nomination of Lord Paddy Ashdown to be the successor in the UN mission in Afghanistan, dual-hatted as the senior NATO civilian representative, with President Hamid Karzai, which led to President Karzai making some statements and leading everyone to believe that there was some uncertainty as if this nomination went through, then who is the real leader? Who is the real decision maker in Afghanistan? President Karzai saying, "I am the one." But of course, there are also a series of policy decisions that sovereign governments insist on making that sometimes impede the ability of international organizations, international donors, international actors to provide the kinds of goods and services that they want to do or to resolve some economic problems. And I point to, again, from my experience in Iraq, the Iraqi government's insistence on maintaining subsidies for petroleum products, which led to a very serious climb in corruption, sabotage, smuggling, and the consequent damage to the economy in petroleum products, until the World Bank and the IMF absolutely insisted that subsidies be mitigated, minimized as much as possible. To look ahead briefly, I'm told that I'm going to get a 5-minute yanking fairly soon. So I posed many questions. There are not very many answers. I hope that we can flesh out some of these issues during our questions and answers later on, accommodating these different decision cycles, determining the legal and regulatory constraints to collaboration, how to identify some of the resource gaps and redundancies, sharing information and databases so we all work off of a common sheet of information to the extent possible. And I would offer this graphic, which I have stolen from the U.S. military, as a vehicle for further discussion, which we can put up a little later, showing the various roles of elements of national power across a time spectrum in conflict scenarios, the horizontal axis being over time from pre-conflict to post-conflict, and the vertical axis being the various levels of effort of the elements of national power. In phase zero, as you will see on the left-hand side, there are military activities in black, I don't know why, diplomatic activities in blue, economic activities in green, and informational, or what I would call strategic communications, public diplomacy, however you want to define that, in red on the top. At the beginning, that's an arbitrary order, except I would argue that your strategic communications really must be your highest level of effort in order to more effectively carry out your activities and achieve your goals across the entire spectrum. So that we can discuss the variety of activities and why the squiggly lines do what they do on this graph later on, leading down into the denouement and the return to normalcy. But the point that I wanted to make is that the coordination among this variety of actors with different cultures must occur in that phase zero, the pre-crisis, the elements of the time of normalcy. Handy little pointer here. In this area right here, sharing of best practices, attending conferences, seminars like this one and like ones that that my own institute provide. Discovering, are there archives for these best practices? Does Mercy Corps, or does the civil affairs community, or does the Department of Agriculture maintain any kind of archive for the best practices in post-conflict scenarios? How do we apply, quote, Western, unquote, business practices, which often flow in times of conflict or post-conflict, with the traditions and cultures of local economies? How do we align those? Of course, these conferences and seminars and the like that occur in phase zero, establish the personal networking among the actors who will eventually be on the ground later on, getting to know who does what, either regionally or functionally. And most importantly, I would argue, to engage in integrated training and exercises among ourselves, not just military and interagency players, but NGOs as well, media actors, I would argue, and most importantly of all, the private sector. I'll do that. But I would also say that there is a second time in which to coordinate, and that is as tension mounts in a certain area or country that potentially could lead to crisis. And therefore, instead of waiting to this intersection here, post-conflict stabilization, to come together, as sometimes we do today, we start right here. And we develop fora for the various actors to be able to coordinate their intentions, their databases, their resources, and so on, so that as we lead through these economic activities, we can coordinate them well with those of the military, those of the diplomats, and finally those of the strategic communicators. Just to finish up quickly, how do we know whether we're succeeding? There are a few measures of success. I would argue that we could use the macroeconomic measures of employment levels, often very difficult in some countries that do not have adequate statistics. But sometimes anecdotal evidence can suffice the numbers of angry young men off the street and into beginning industries or in agricultural fields so that employment levels begin to go up and violence levels begin to go down, the levels of foreign direct investment, exchange rate stability, and so on. Secondly, the prevention of a return to conflict, the establishment of safety in neighborhoods, a sense of security in the country, reconstruction beginning, and so on. I would mention, too, that one of the important tools in preventing a return to that backsliding into conflict is what we call track to diplomacy, which often occurs when tension begins to mount. And you find facilitators and others who have credibility intervening among the factions who are at loggerheads to try to bring them to understand what are the underlying problems and grievances. Track two diplomacy often, if it is successful, can lead to building a base, a foundation that will tend to underpin any political agreement that track one diplomacy or conflict has generated. There are a number of socioeconomic indicators, but I would say that the building of health clinics and the number of schools built is not one of them. You really need to look at basic service utilization rates. If a health clinic has no healthcare professionals in it, or if potential patients have no way to get to a health clinic, or in the case of Afghanistan, schools built but no teachers in them, so that children go to the school and either are taught by other students or by the handful of teachers that then have to take two and three shifts. Schools have to close down in wintertime and so on and so forth. So if there are true utilization rates, that might be a measure of economic recovery. And then there are a few anecdotal successes that may help to establish that psychology of hope. I talked about law enforcement successes against major crime groups or against major terrorist organizations, a major investment event by a foreign entity, or a major infrastructure inauguration event, a port, an airport, or opening up a major road that has been critical to economic development. All of which need to be, in some way, transmitted to the people. By a television, radio, by meetings in towns, and so on. The important point is transmitting that kind of anecdotal information to the people. So with that, I think I'd better close, and thank you very much, and look forward to talking with you a little bit later.
Good morning. I wonder how I'm going to manage to follow an ambassador in the business of, you know, oratory, but I'll try. I don't have a PowerPoint presentation, but I do want to start by thanking the Institute of Peace, as well as Raymond particularly, for inviting me to participate in this very important discourse. I do want to say that for anyone who managed to turn out to come to this event, clearly, you are interested in the issues that normally are not the everyday interests of our world. The world would rather talk about the things that concern the continuous well-being of those that are already doing well. And so to focus on the issues of post-conflict environment where you have citizens that mostly don't even know what tomorrow or the next hour could be is definitely something that I want to applaud you for turning out for our discussion. I do want to state clearly that most of what characterize a post-conflict environment have been taken up very eloquently by Ambassador himself. And based on what he said, focusing on the issues of the weak human and financial capacity, the damaged infrastructure and institutions, the weak or non-existent rule of law, the inability of these environments to deliver basic services to their populations, and often the lack of control over even the territory that constitutes the capital city is the fact that markets don't work in these economies, and that even life at the subsistence level is pretty tough and difficult. Underlying these terrible conditions that I've painted is really the next citizen in this environment who is clearly steeped in poverty and traumatized by the many years of violence and neglect. But I loved what he said, because in my own paper, I then said, but there is hope. And you did indicate that psychology of hope is critical in the process of rebuilding. With peace often comes a sense that a better future is possible, that the wounds of the conflict can be healed, and that there will be peace dividend in the form of access to basic services, to jobs and to livelihoods, and to peaceful and secure environment. When a conflict ends, there is often a small window of opportunity when the donors move fast enough in order to send a signal of partnership and hope. But if this window that is very slight and very slim does not really deliver something visible quick enough, what happens is that the window quickly closes, and people begin to wonder whether indeed there is any difference between the periods of conflict and the periods of peace. I had a practical example of this when recently the officials of the MPLA, SLPA, the Sudanese party, had meetings with me, and they said, Madam Vice President, some of our citizens are beginning to ask, what's the difference between when we were at war and now that we have peace? That's a practical case of citizens believing that with peace should come something different. What's the bank response in post-conflict environments? What are we doing? What do we do on a daily basis to focus on these issues toward improving our response to post-conflict countries? Post-conflict reconstruction has been a major focus for the World Bank since the late 90s, but the agenda is being very much re-energized, especially since President Zulik identified support for fragile and conflict-affected states as one of the six key priority themes for his presidency. Over the past years, we have done a lot to improve our capacity to respond, and in a timely manner too, and we're striving toward accelerated improvement. I'd like to highlight just a few. In February 2007, a new policy for engagement in emergency and crisis settings was approved by the board of the bank. This fragile state policy allows us to deploy much faster, to streamline approval mechanisms, to strengthen our field presence in these countries, and to review the internal incentives structures that are aimed at attracting the best of human capital within our institution and elsewhere to these difficult environments. As part of these efforts, we have just launched a callable roster of staff who are experienced in working on conflict countries and who are usually available to be deployed at a very, very short notice. But I have to say to you that in spite of how great it sounds, it's the toughest part of the job to be able to get in, attracting the best of human capital to risky environments. But it is a work in progress. We're also increasing financial resources to support post-conflict countries. IDA, which is the International Development Association, that's our concessional lending arm, the concessional window, has provided $5.9 billion in assistance to post-conflict reconstruction over the past 7 years, of which 75%, amounting to $4.4 billion, was for Africa. IDA 15, it comes in three yearly tranches, and so we this year ends either 14, either 15 starts the next fiscal year. And for either 15, our current funding cycle, our next funding cycle, includes more flexible mechanisms that would help these countries to clear arrears to the bank so that we can re-engage with them on faster through the regular lending operations. The arrears clearance, for instance, it's normally a difficult process for a country that's just gone through very difficult times. But one of the things that's happened in the last couple of years has been the galvanizing of support, both on the multilateral, amongst the multilateral institutions as well as the bilaterals, toward ensuring that this happens. I do have a colleague, who was part of this process for Liberia. And this happened recently, only sometime this week. We just concluded the arrears clearance for Cote d'Ivoire. So CAR also happened. So these are examples of how, by getting a system around this kind of a process, the re-engagement of these countries in regular financial activities and development partnership is made a lot easier. Recognizing that post-conflict environments of post-conflict countries face higher financing needs, IDA 15 also extends exceptional allocation of concessional financing for post-conflict countries above what they would normally receive based on the performance-based approach on which the IDA is built. The IDA principle is that it's a complex mechanism for determining and incentivizing performance so that that enables you to actually get countries to stay on the path of the kinds of reforms that would enable government itself deliver the dividends of governance to the citizens. But when it's a post-conflict environment, there's some exceptionalisms that have been allowed to enabling them to be treated in that kind of in recognition of the peculiar circumstances that they have to grapple with. We're also expanding the use of small grants to conflict-affected countries, which will allow us to be to have a more predictable and quicker funding sources for these countries in order to facilitate even more their recovery. Only recently, we asked the board of the bank to approve $100 million over a three-year period for a state and peace-building grant fund that will help finance early bank engagement and pilot innovative approaches in fragile states and post-conflict conflict-affected countries. Despite all of these efforts, we know we cannot, as a bank, do it alone. So we're strengthening our collaboration and coordination with external partners, and the ambassador did allude very eloquently to this. It's not normally the case that institutions and nations have a desire to lay down their flags and pick up the flags of others. And so sometimes that creates the greatest difficulty in the rescue operation that seeks to work with post-conflict environments. But the truth is, if we stepped back and said to ourselves, whose good are we trying to serve? That would help us to get greater harmonization of this ideal to being the one that's most delivered to specific environments. And so we are working with the United Nations system on a common fiduciary framework so that we can eliminate bureaucratic delays when each agency uses a different system. We're also working with the UN system, multilateral development banks, and the European Union on shared planning tools such as joint needs assessment and multi-donor trust funds that allow us to pull together donor expertise and resources under a common framework. I want to specifically touch on the importance of strong collaboration between the United Nations and the African Union. These institutions have a mandate on peace and security. Without security and peace, our efforts at ensuring development outcomes would have limited impact. And we're not an institution called to the political process. We're a development institution. We do better when we stay within the framework of the development and economic agenda. And therefore, being able to integrate in a seamless kind of way with the political ones, the ones that can handle those aspects of security and peace-related dimensions of rebuilding, is going to be key and critical for the improvement of these environments. Similarly, and working with the private sector arm of the bank, the International Finance Corporation, we are targeting support that enables us rebuild the private sector in post-conflict settings with a special focus on small and medium-scale enterprises. This would ensure greater stability in these countries as citizens begin to see that peace does indeed have its dividends. Given the growing importance of China in Africa, bank staff have recently met. I actually, only a few weeks ago, was a guest of the Chinese government, discussing with the Ministry of Finance, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of China, on who are interested in looking at examples of how the bank operates with other partners, especially in terms of co-financing arrangements and the links between peacekeeping operations and development activities. I do want to say that Africa has a significant proportion of the countries that are emerging from conflict. It was therefore critical for a dedicated unit to be created within the Africa region of the bank to help us do a better job of supporting countries in crisis. The Fragile States and Conflict Unit became operational earlier in July of 2007, and is the only such unit within the World Bank. Through this unit, we're in the process of locating conflict advisors in key countries, Cote d'Ivoire, Sudan, Uganda, Somalia, based in Nairobi, to provide more specialized support to our country teams and to prepare for early engagement in prolonged crises such as Darfur. The unit also manages one of the most ambitious programs to demobilize and reintegrate ex-combatants in the Great Lakes region, where we are managing a multi-donor partnership that aims to demobilize over 300,000 ex-fighters. The bank remains committed to assisting countries affected by conflict, irrespective of the significant challenges that we still confront. Permit me, therefore, to briefly touch upon what, in my view, can be considered the unfinished agenda, especially as it relates to Africa. First, we do need to do much better in creating jobs. The fact is, it's got to be about jobs, jobs, jobs. The truth is, and I normally say it in the most ordinary way, how often do you find somebody on Hay Street picking up a wall with the other person that's walking on the street? That's because the stakes are just too high for taking up a fight on Hay Street. The fellows who are on Hay Street have something to that they are looking up for. It's easier to pick up a fight on a different street because the stakes are much lower. So jobs, having a source of income, is so important. The most of ordinary things that can make the difference in these environments, creating jobs. The truth is that for the young people who are often the foot soldiers of the conflict, it is that there is no other path that is seen. So the best path is to be armed with that gun and to do everything possible with it. And so how do we make them not continue to feel alienated and marginalized? Post-conflict economies can in fact recover quickly, or recover much quickly, with reasonable high growth rates, but the growth is not the statistical kind of growth. It's the job creating growth. Because now, the more we say that countries are growing, the more we get a retort who is benefiting from the growth. And so job creating growth is very important to really pulling everyone together. In Liberia, for instance, we have worked with donors on emergency employment schemes around public works. But these efforts are difficult to sustain and fund. This is a difficult problem which, if unaddressed, presents the risk of return to conflict or the creation of young men who see no future and who would resort to criminality and antisocial behavior. Of course, this problem doesn't confront only post-conflict environments, but in these environments, the risks are much higher. When there's a generation of young people who have been used to violence, this was very evident during a recent trip that myself and President Zolik took to Africa, and we feel we have to try harder for conflict and non-conflict countries alike. I've set up a small team in my region and asked them to look at this problem and for us to come out with specific, quick, rapid interventions that will take care of this. I see a nexus between the current rising food prices, Africa's slowdown in agric productivity, and the huge army of the unemployed. Something, and the development of new skills that can facilitate the traction that needs to happen concerning the new sources of growth that we begin to see in some of these environments. Something is there. And we just need to find it and connect all of the points together. But we must create opportunities to address the massive youth unemployment around the continent. Second, we are doing much better in terms of donor coordination and harmonizing our approaches in conflict settings. But I think we can still do more. We have had excellent donor partnerships, for example, in Liberia, where we adopted a joint approach to governance, the GMAP, and in DRC, where our country assistance strategy is based on a common donor platform. However, there are still many donors and NGOs with fragmented and small-scale approaches that place a heavy tax on the capacity of very weak government systems. Also, many programs still bypass the ministries and the government budget, making it very difficult for government to have a comprehensive picture of what every donor is doing and where the money is going. Third, and related to the above point, I think we should be doing a lot more to work with African institutions, especially the African Development Bank, the African Union, the Economic Commission for Africa, and NEPAD. We would like to see greater capacity in these institutions and the ability to take a leadership role in addressing the continent's conflicts. We have started to work more closely with these institutions, especially the Africa Union. With the Africa Union, we have recently moved toward a memorandum of understanding. One of the key points of activities for it is the fragile states and how we deliver development there. With the Africa Development Bank, we're preparing joint country strategies for CAR and Liberia. We're increasing co-financing in conflict countries like the DRC and in collaborating with staff training and exchanges. We're working closely with the AU on the crisis in Darfur, especially in better coordination of peacekeeping efforts and development activities, and in supporting the Africa Union with diagnostic work as well as stakeholder dialogue in Darfur. Fourth, capacity and institution building remains one of the most serious challenges in countries emerging from conflict. We know how difficult it is to strengthen capacity under normal circumstances, but the challenge is even more enormous where conflict has destroyed institutions and there's very little human capacity. We believe, for us at the bank, we believe that our diaspora initiative, which aims at leveraging Africans in the diaspora for development, is a very important step toward resolving some of these capacity issues. This is even more so for countries emerging from conflict, with majority of their citizens being diaspora. How quickly we are able to integrate them to the development of their countries would require a lot of collaborative effort by ourselves and the Africa Union that has considered them the sixth region of Africa. Finally, I think that in a place like in recognizing that increased financial resources to support post-conflict countries is fundamental to their recovery, under IDA 15, we only have $40 million per annum for Liberia and the same amount for Sierra Leone. This is just a drop in the bucket compared to what these countries need. to rebuild after conflict, especially in infrastructure. We face similar problems in other post-conflict countries. So we need to be more creative in terms of using our idle resources as a catalytical seed for galvanizing other sources of finance for these infrastructure reconstruction that's very, very key and fundamental to growth. That creativity is permeating the way that we begin to look at our operations and the way that our teams work in these countries. I've spoken a lot about the challenges of helping countries emerge from conflict, but I think that it is important to also focus on what we do to make sure that countries don't even slide into conflict. How do we not let it happen? I have had instances where I said, are we helpless and seemingly waiting for a collapse to happen so that we can all then begin to run around trying to put together? Must humpity dumpity fall before we try putting it together again? I think that that aspect is becoming very critical, being able to have early warning signals that point us in the direction of the kind of new forms of support that countries would need in order to hold together. I believe that we have come a long way from the period when we felt that conflicts are not our business, but that of foreign ministries and peacekeepers. Presently, we are much more aware of the role of development and of the linkages with diplomacy, with peace and security efforts. I agree that many African countries need to get stronger and less vulnerable to instability, but generally, the continent looks much more stable than it did a decade ago. We must recognize that. We can only be confident of an emergent Africa that is more peaceful and prosperous. Let me end once again by thanking the Institute of Peace for giving me the opportunity to have this dialogue today, and I really look forward to a robust conversation following afterward. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very good. Thank you.
Pleasure for me to be here as well. Ray was much too kind in my introduction, though. I was one of the first hires for the Polish American Enterprise Fund, and I drafted the business plan for the fund, but that, the successes of that fund and the other enterprise funds that follow, which I'm going to talk about, are a collective effort. It was the State Department, USAID, it was the management of the funds, it was the board of directors that the funds put together, and hopefully we all contributed to a good measure of success. Which ones of these things do I push? What do I push? Plus? This one?
No.
That one. Okay, good. I'm going to talk about empowering the private sector, because essentially that's what we did with the enterprise funds. Is it working? What? There we go. Turn it around. I'm going to talk about the principles behind it. I'm going to talk about the enterprise funds, some of the things we succeeded, and then I'm going to talk about the principles behind the enterprise funds. Because those principles may have application to post-conflict situations, conflict-affected countries, preventing conflict. As Anyway, so we've already talked about a lot of the challenges, the absence of rule of law. One of the biggest challenges in places like Africa is violence that stems from poverty. So how do you provide opportunities for a massive population? That's one of the keys. And one of the things that we see in almost every economy around the world, it's the SME sector that is the driving business growth. But they lack financing, lack technical support. And then the question is, how do you deploy capital quickly and effectively? It's not just a matter of putting money out there. A lot of money, there's a lot of money that goes into these societies and economies, but how do you do it effectively? And how do you make it broadly available to local entrepreneurs? We come back to this main point. It's giving people hope in the future and a stake in stability. How do you do that? That's the key. And one of it, as Ms. Obi said very eloquently, it's quickly providing economic opportunity. That's what you can build peace on. And it has to be sustainable. It's not just a matter of creating a few jobs, and then those jobs aren't sustainable. Back in 1989, there were daunting challenges. These were unprecedented transformation from command economy to free markets. There were no roadmaps. The risks were unknown. Somebody had to help define those risks. Private capital follows risk-reward ratios. They don't go in if they don't know where the risks are. Vast social dislocation was underway and getting worse. You had weak ecosystems we talked about. So it's a matter of degree. We didn't have the same kind of conflict, violent conflict. There was in a couple of countries, I think in Romania, there was some. But basically, you didn't have a society ripped apart. But as a matter of degree, you have similar kind of situations. And the important thing to remember is systemic change takes time. And the open question was, will the public lose hope and turn back? Somebody smart, I don't know who it was, a lot of people take credit today, in the U.S. government, recognized that we need to have our whole panoply of aid programs and humanitarian assistance programs and policy reform programs, but we also need to have a program that deploys capital, puts capital into the hands of the private sector, professionally, though. And that was needed to fuel business growth in Poland and Hungary, give broader public stake in society, and demonstrate that the prospects for the future were going to be better than the past. And they created what's called the Enterprise Funds. And this is the SEED Act. It's very simple, very straightforward. There weren't a whole bunch of metrics. There weren't a whole bunch of requirements. They created the Enterprise Funds to promote political, well, the SEED Act was to promote political democracy and economic pluralism, build private business, build democratic institutions. The Enterprise Funds were to promote development of the indigenous private sectors and policies and practices conducive to private sector development. And basically it was through equity investments, loans, putting capital to work in businesses. And that second point is something that I'm going to come back to repeatedly, because by creating those opportunities, creating those businesses, by doing those deals, you begin to create the ecosystem. So it's a bottoms-up approach instead of a tops-down approach. The mandate of the enterprise funds. As I said, we had $240 million for Poland, $60 million for Hungary. I worked with both of those funds over a 15-year period. It was a dualistic mission, commercial and development. So we had a developmental mission, but we had to do it on commercial terms. That was the smart way to do it. That was how you make decisions in a free market. This was not a command economy. We were making market-based decisions. The focus was on the microeconomic level, creating macroeconomic impacts. We had to act quickly. We had to put capital into the hands of those entrepreneurs to grow their business, to demonstrate the benefits, to support local market development, like the stock exchanges, and to build the institutional infrastructure, the ecosystem that facilitates commercial activity then. We also had some technical assistance money that we could dovetail in with our investment money. And we had a mandate to attract private capital to leverage those initial public funds. And you're going to find out how we leverage them. The important thing to remember is that this was a sustainable commercial investment entity. It wasn't a project. We were not there to spend a little time, to build a road, to count our days to come home. We were building a business that was building other businesses. My colleagues, I just visited with them 2 weeks ago in Warsaw. Rob Mance, who I worked with, has been here 17 years now. He's executive vice president of the successor to the management team of the Polish American Enterprise Fund. He is managing $1.6 billion in Poland and Hungary. Oops, too far. So what are the basic elements of that model? That a private sector vehicle capitalized with public funding was executing a developmental mission to demonstrate the investment opportunities and then attract others. The focus was on business to business. We were providing capital on commercial terms. Of course, you know, we softened those terms a little because we had to get the job done. We had to figure out how to get the job done and make it happen. Capital was entrusted to an independent board. President appointed our boards of directors. and they were from the private sector. And then they hired professional managers to get on the ground and actually do roll up the sleeves and do the dirty work. But that board defined strategy. Again, there was no roadmap. And they were mandated with creating and defining the strategy because they would be looking at these issues in a different way than someone who is in a government agency, a contractor, an NGO. These were business people. These were investment professionals. John Berkland, chairman of Dillon Reed, Nick Brady's protege, was appointed by president to chair the Polish Fund. He was. We had Lane Kirkland from AFL-CIO, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Charles Harper from ConAgra, and Jack Smith, chairman of General Motors. Hungarian Fund, John Whitehead, who needs no introduction. His vice chairman, George Gould, undersecretary of Treasury of the United States, and founder and chairman of Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenneret. George is still chairman. He's 17 years he's been doing this. He's done it pro bono. So they defined a strategy because they had to execute quickly. They were given the flexibility to set that direction and to take action quickly to achieve objectives without government interference. We had the mandate. We had the oversight from GAO, from Inspector General to make sure nobody stole the money. We didn't go off and buy yachts in Miami, things like that. And the objectives were to get the job done quickly. The capital was not dissipated in expenditures, but it's invested in enterprises. So these were assets on our books and remain so. And then again, coming back to that point, realities of investing ultimately drive policy reform. By making these investments, by working with notaires, helping them to understand what a new market economy is like with the lawyers and others, and we help create the ecosystem to support commerce. I love this. We're talking about innovative. We're talking about creative solutions. Well, somebody was very creative. This is Ken Juster, who was a senior advisor to Larry Eagleburger back then. And he said, enterprise funds are a bold experiment in a new way of delivering economic assistance. And they sure were. That it's a means of tapping private expertise to manage grants. These are some of the high points. And they wanted to manage grants in a way an investment banker might do, because that's what they recognized needed to be done in the context of Central Europe, unencumbered by bureaucratic constraints normally associated with government activities, and multiply many times over those original grants. So I'm just going to talk about some of the programs. Of course, we had our small lending program. We set it up at South Shore Bank of Chicago. It was one of the early ones. There are a lot of these programs now. One of the things that we did, though, was we made it into a business. This is another way we built sort of an ecosystem. We set up windows with the banks, so we transferred skills to the Polish banks. We had thousands of people that queued up for the money. We had to close the program because the Poles didn't quite understand that this was not free money from the United States. These were going to be loans. They had to establish a credit worthiness. I want two pigs. We had to explain to them. So we had applications. We redid the applications, 13-page applications. They said they learned more from filling out the applications than they ever knew before. They would ask us, what kind of business? We have to be in a business. What kind of business do you want us to be in? Some of them would go out and fill out the applications on the street. They came back, and as I said, many of them told us later, we learned about our business. We didn't get the money, but Yatsek down the street got the money. So they understood that the change was coming. This was one of the brainchilds of Professor Balsarovich. He said, you can't just do private equity. You got to spread the impact. So let's spread the impact quickly. Well, getting down to the bottom line, after about a 10-year operation, 10,000 private SMEs had received nearly $300 million in business loans. We started with $13 million. When I was there, they put in, I think, another 15. I don't know how much more they might have put in, but they were recycling the money. Another Polish-American mortgage bank. Poland needed 2 million homes. So we had a strategy. We were going to invest in home building companies, right? So they can build some homes. But then we said, they can build about 10 homes. Who's going to buy them? There's no mortgage banking. So we needed that. So we worked with AID. We brought over some technical assistance on our own. We worked with AID. They put together a larger technical assistance program on mortgage bank. We helped educate the Polish government. And then we actually set up the bank. And we put it in place. And then we told the Polish government, here it is. We can start this bank today. And So it was tangible. It wasn't theoretical. We got to change in the law, and when we got to change in the law, our CEO said to me, he said, I don't know whether the courts are going to enforce it, but let's go. Because he was a risk taker. He was a leading venture capitalist. So, you know, just some of the highlights. Polish fund had $240 million, to $200 million in 50 Polish companies, $300 in loans, $180. They returned the money to U.S. Treasury after 10 years of operation. First time any foreign assistance program of this sort, as I understand it, has returned money since the Finns repaid the Marshall Plan. The privatized fund now has raised $1.6 billion in a series of funds and attracted multiple competitors. We did something similar in Hungary. It's been adapted to other countries. But the important thing is to remember is that the strategies of each are dictated by local needs and conditions. So you just can't take what we did in Poland and plop it into Bulgaria. You can't take what we did in Poland and plop it into Iraq. You have to adapt it. But what are the principles? Well, overall, we had $1.2 billion in funding from grant funding. That money was put to work, building businesses, building capacity, facilitating development of ecosystem, and creating a professional cadre, and the money still remains intact, and it's coming back to the U.S. and setting up in foundations. A Bulgarian fund with $55 million will return $27 million to the U.S. Treasury and retain in-country $200 to $400 million in a foundation to continue development. So what are some of the principles? So again, we talked about the equity stake. Stake in society, and that's what contributes to middle classes. People who own businesses, that's who has the stake. Private sector approaches produce better, quicker, and more sustainable results. We were just talking about the problem of maintaining, creating jobs, creating sustainable jobs, doing it on an emergency basis. How do you make it sustainable? It's businesses that create jobs. And development agencies need to create businesses, not jobs. They create businesses, and the businesses create the jobs. Providing a direct opportunity for the little people creates a lot bigger impact than creating grandiose institutions, because it takes time to create those. So you need to spread that impact, and it goes from the bottom up. Taking action and adjusting is better than building the perfect system, like we do with our mortgage bank. And that's what the private sector can do, because they're nimble. They can make decisions quickly. They can take risks that others can't. And again, addressing the microeconomic factors from the bottom up. What were some of the lessons learned? Results are achieved through professionally deployed capital on a business-to-business basis. Private sector approaches backed by capital like the enterprise fund model need to take those early risks. When President Zolik was talking about the sovereign wealth funds coming in, they're looking for risk and return ratio and rewards. It's public capital that will define the risks, and somebody has to do that first. You need that intermediary step. That's what we did with the enterprise funds. This is a catalyst at the microeconomic level that supports the framework. And in these economies, it's not purely a commercial play. You have to do those socioeconomic development things. And so that's why you need this sort of public vehicle with public capital, but managed privately. And the fundamentals are the same, whether you're in Budapest or Boston, Afghanistan or America. It's management, management, management. And private investors can pick the management. Command economy officials were never able to pick management. They could set the requirements, but they couldn't pick management. As some of the other lessons, you tap local demand like we did with Euronet. We set up an ATM network in Hungary because it was a Czech society rolled into Poland. Now it's a global corporation listed on NASDAQ. Critical mass of capital and staying power is critical. We had $240 million in Poland, $60 million in Hungary. It wasn't enough for Hungary. You need to have a critical mass of capital, and you have the staying power because you have people that are around that capital managing it and as fiduciaries and bringing it home, like we have with our board and our management team. That's the committed professionals with a stake. They're critical for success. Again, systemic change takes time. Tangible action drives change. You don't wait for the perfect system. Now, how can private sector approaches contribute to recovery? By identifying the necessary building blocks in this society, this locale, like we did. And of course, we did it in one context. Those same principles could be applied in other contexts. By moving quickly to demonstrate opportunities and showing that help and change are on their way. By providing a foundation for satisfying human needs, basic human needs. Commerce is taking place in all of these war-torn places. It's taking place every day. How do people eat? Do they just go out and pick it up? Some of them go out and pick it off the trees. But basically, somebody's transferring something. Now, how do you channel that? How do you tap that? How do you capitalize on it? How do you build the better ones so that then they have a stake? You start small, you have a broad impact across society, sustained by profit principles, and then you mobilize others. That's how others come in. That's when the private sector investors come in, and that's why when local investors have confidence in their economy, you take risk to instill hope in the future. So in dissipating these kind of situations, they offer opportunities. You have to develop a viable local private sector to serve the needs of the local masses, and that is what's critical to sustainable recovery. It mitigates the risk that paves the way for the multinationals and others. It gives vitality to traditional development assistance. You know, what does policy reform mean if you don't have anybody, if you don't have anything tangible happening in terms of on the ground, businesses growing, creating jobs, institution building? Who does those institutions serve? They serve those private sector companies. Education, 5, 10, 15 years, do you have that kind of time? You have to do those things, but you also need this quick catalyst. Private sector decision-making and risk-taking approaches can provide speedy and long-term results. Enterprise fund is just a model, and its experiences are illustrative. So in conclusion, you have to ask yourself in these situations, what are the bare essentials to build forward from? What are the decks? What is the cards that we have for right now, and how do we go from there? And then remember, how you define the problem dictates the solution you seek. And the interrelationships between business drivers and development needs have to be understood. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Time is fast spent. We have about 15, 20 minutes for questions and answers. I believe this mic is live. If you have questions, please make your way to the microphone. We'll take sets of three questions at a time. Please make your questions as concise as possible so the panel will be able to react. Sir.
I'm Brian Murphy. Thank you for a most interesting presentation. And, sir, not only can we not pronounce Obi's last name, I can't begin to pronounce your last name. Can you tell me?
Skrobyshevsky.
Like Ms. Slivich at our law school.
Terrific.
Sir, it is to you that I wish to address this question. I spent a good bit of time in Iraq, unfortunately, before the ambassador, maybe going back soon. I understand the Iraqi-American Chamber of Commerce is planning to come to Washington in May and again a few months later. Whom can we refer them to see if an enterprise fund might be appropriate for Iraq's needs now, please?
There was an enterprise fund announced by Ambassador Crocker in testimony in August. And as I understand, I don't know where that stands, but he recommended to Congress that one be created. And I understood that they were looking for the money to do so. And again, it's not going to be the enterprise fund like the Polish. If they try to do what the Polish fund did, I don't think it would work effectively. It has to be adapted to the needs, conditions, and strategies and objectives that we want to achieve in Iraq today. But I know that people are looking at this. National Security Council Director for Iraq is looking at it, and I know state. And in fact, when I was in Poland, my colleagues in the Polish fund said, "Oh, we had some people here from State Department a couple months back. They were asking about enterprise funds and how it works and how it might apply to Iraq." So people are looking at it.
Thank you.
My question is for Ms. Obi. I'm Judah Moore from Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. A few months ago, I got to listen to the president of Senegal, and he said that when African countries try to get money, if they approach an institution like the World Bank, there's all these complications in getting the money, but when they go to China, it's easy. I mean, they talk to the Chinese today and tomorrow to get the money. Now, how is that coordination working? I'm assuming the complications he's talking about were put in place so that it can ensure that the money is used for its purpose or that the money is repaid. Now, if China is just giving them the money without those complications, how does that affect what you're trying to achieve?
I think that's a very good question and very topical. The basic
and fundamental thing is that ultimately it's going to depend on the citizens of countries to determine the levels of accountability that they want of their government. And this this demand for accountability is really a key and fundamental to how countries begin to negotiate and enter into transactions, whether it be with multilateral institutions or with bilateral partners. So in the case of the way that the bank or other institutions are perceived in the African continent, I think that more is going in the direction of countries being in the driver's seat of the demand that they want to make of any partner. To that effect, what we are putting a lot of stress on is that it is not so much as avoiding the World Bank or avoiding the African Development Bank for its policies or regulations on the basis of which it expects good lending operations to happen, and operations that would ensure that certain policy initiatives that would enable good usage of resources begin to be considered as detrimental to the need of a country. The president of Senegal himself, who said this, knows that his own country, for instance, is a high-performing country when it comes to the issues of policy reforms that have to happen. Now, in the case of China, if the China Exim Bank, which is the agency through which most of the lending operations that China does in Africa happens, recognize that there are pitfalls ahead, and that, you know, clearly it would be totally incomprehensible how you can repeat a performance that was not useful in the case of people who acted before you did. So there is experience to be learned from the debt unsustainability challenges that happened in the continent in the past. And so a lot of that is coming together in the discussion on collaborating more between all of these institutions, as well as the new players. The new players come with faster response to the huge infrastructure deficit that is in the continent. Yet, there are pitfalls that need to be looked at for, and there are opportunities that they get in aligning with the clear experiences that have been garnered by other institutions, including ours.
Hi. I'm Don Ritter, I'm a former member of U.S. Congress and been involved with Afghanistan for nigh on 30 years, and very much involved in helping Afghanistan arrive at a market economy today, and also as a private businessman. I've been back 22 times since 9/11 alone. I want to thank USIP and the panelists for a great and energizing panel. I wanted to just point out one observation that I have from my own experience, and I think it kind of focuses somewhat on what Francis Robuszewski, I can pronounce that, by the way, I'm very proud of that, потому что я по-русски говорю свободно, which means I speak a Slavic language, so words like that are come easy. But the bottom line to U.S. policy, foreign policy, is this, to me, is that foreign policy needs to be a table with three basic legs. One, of course, is your State Department leg. They do the diplomacy, they coordinate the humanitarian assistance programs. The other is the military. They do the war fighting. There is an almost total absence of a third leg, and that is the economic leg. And I'm not talking about policy. I am talking about business. I'm talking about the private sector, the only job-creating capacity known to our human experience is business and the private sector. Now, if you look at the robustness of our military leg, if you look at the robustness of our diplomatic leg, of our policy institutions, you know, myriad NGOs and institutes, wonderful organizations, all,
But where is the robustness of the job-creating, private sector-based, market economy-based economically? It doesn't exist. The Commerce Department, as you know, is really minimalist. It's not really a player. The State Department's trying to do some of these economic dimensions, but they have no capacity. Foreign service officers are not businessmen. They're mostly not economists. They're junior level people when they go into these countries like Afghanistan. They're good people, all of them, but they haven't a clue about business. And I guess I see a lot of young people here. And as a former professor, I might say, I'm interested that think about these dimensions, this lack in our overall national, really global capacity in a global economy where markets and business are driving everything and anything. We're at a zeroth level on this kind of power base, a pillar. Let's say three pillars are necessary to hold the table up. We've got two. And we desperately need the third. What Francis is talking about is a component part. It's something that needs far greater focus. But when you think about it, we don't have the ability to provide that focus. In fact, the government is antagonistic to somehow the public tax money supporting private business initiative. So, spaceship to mission control, we've got a problem, and I would urge you to think about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. In the interest of time, we would have the, I think there were four people, four questions, and then I'll turn it over to the panel to respond to these questions and make concluding remarks. So I think there were four people in the queue. Could you ask your questions, please?
Thank you. My name is Yuta Tobias. I'm interning at the American Psychological Association, and I've been very excited to hear the word psychology of hope mentioned by Ambassador Litt. And it's been really, really exciting to hear about the efforts that the two other speakers, Madame Obi and Mr. Trobizhevsky, have mentioned. As you said, Madame Obi, there's such a short window of time at the end of a conflict, and that gives people the opportunity to have hope. And as you, Mr. Trobizhevsky, said, illustrated, there's very little time, and nobody has time when they go and help. Could you speak a little bit more to any of you to the need to build trust and the need to build the ability and the capacities of the local people at the grassroots level to actually become entrepreneurs that are good managers? Because in my experience, we never have enough time to spend to let people on the ground become as university trained as we are, and then we leave. And that's, in my view, one of the biggest problems. And I would love to hear some more on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Hi, I'm Ted Carty with Project One. We're an NGO focused primarily on Africa, on the continent of Africa, and we, the basis of our plan today there is, it's economics, it's building jobs, building manufacturing. On that we build, we try to build volunteerism, we train the employees. They contribute about 10 hours a week volunteer time. They own the companies that we develop. Our feeling is that largely what they need is exports in Africa. It's a closed market to a great extent, and it's kind of a system doomed to run down. And I was wondering what you, if that's pretty accurate, if you felt that mostly what they need is exports. And also, I was wondering what kinds of support we might be able to expect or obtain from organizations like your own, in the way of financial, but nurturing, mentoring and so forth, guidance, if those are actually things that are available.
Thank you very much. Next question, please.
Thank you very much. My name is Ali Al-Dujali. I work for the government of Iraq in senior ranking positions. That's from 1978 to 1992. I have some points that I would like to address to Ambassador Leth and Ms. Izokosiri. We are always talking about the problems and the situations. What we didn't talk about, the prevention, how to prevent the cases of terrorism and insurgency or the violence. This is very important. In the programs that of USAID, for example, World Bank, NGOs, most of the program didn't consider to build the program as much as culturally sensitive and building the trust. Democracy is not the answer to terrorism, but creating a peaceful society that provides a prosperous opportunity is. What's happening in the programs now in Iraq, for instance, most of the programs didn't produce a tangible result. One of the immediate challenges, what Ambassador let's say, that needs, in my opinion, is to build the capacity of institutions. Iraq has the institutions before during the previous regime, but it was authoritarian. I'm a technocrat. I was working for that government as a technocrat in a high-rank position. But because of the crisis, the polishing, updating the rule of law and the system was not from 1980 when the Iraq-Iran war until 2003, and now after the CPA resolutions, everything is destroyed and collapsed. We have to, the programs should be started on there. Now they are spending billions of dollars, but no result. I did myself a study. I call it Building Momentum for Reform. And I send it to top-ranking people at the DOD. I hope they will read it. But the indication is not. It was an initiative. What Mr. Dr. Ambassador Led say in the international intervention, who will provide, how and when? I would like to add what to provide. This is very important. But we are not just to talk and leave the key people say, talk, speak what you like, and we do what we like. I myself hear a lot of comments in the Senate, Congress, about the corruption. Corruption in Iraq was limited with the family and the regime before. Now corruption is spread all over Iraq because there is a corruption within the programs. And this should be addressed as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mike?
Good morning, panelists, and thank you for this opportunity. I'm Mike Brannick. I teach nation building and the rejuvenation of war-torn societies at the National Defense University. I'm also an economist, economic development specialist. Got two questions and one comment. Question number one, Ambassador, you talked about institutions. Are you including institutions as you talk about infrastructures. Are you including institutions as part of the infrastructure? Because that's very important. We don't separate because the institutions are what makes a nation state to build capacity. And in order to have institutions, you need education. It takes 20 years to build a PhD. It takes 25 years to build an MD. If you don't have the institutions, the less capacity, the more conflict. Less capacity, the more corruption. I mean, I do all these modeling and write on this area. The other question is, and Francis, you and I have had this discussion in Armenia, is that some of our models were great. Adam Smith doesn't work. His concept doesn't work any longer. It worked early on for the United States, but it doesn't work for other countries for a lot of reasons. But when I look at Africa, we've had 60 years of throwing money at Africa. You know, what are we going to do different? Throwing money, and we talk about building businesses, building jobs. you know, where is the capacity? You know, you have to have a limited capacity in the government for establishing laws and for providing security. You know, Hungary had it, Germany had it, Russia didn't have it, and look what happened initially with all the corruption that went on there very early on. So we got to look at the institutions of building the capacity for institutions, and that takes educated people, and none of you spoke about education. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to present the panel with Mission Impossible. If you could summarize in 2 to 3 minutes each and just make some closing statements. We'll start at the end with Francis and move.
Yeah. No, I'm just looking at the various questions. Well, one is on an issue of we help and leave. That's the difference with the model of the enterprise fund because, as I said, my colleagues have not left. They're there. When they invest in businesses, they're not investing in projects. I was touched by an article I read on the front page of Washington Post about 6 months ago. It was a woman building a road in Afghanistan, and she hoped the road would do a lot of good, but it was a project. She was going to go home, and she and her colleagues were counting the days until they go home, and then they'll look back and say, well, I hope that worked, and There's not that connection, and so it's not a matter of leaving. It's staying there and working with them and continuing to work because you have a stake. If you have a stake in something, you stay and deal with it. On this issue of the other question on exports and so forth, I left the Polish fund to manage one of the mass privatization funds in Poland. We were privatizing 550 companies in one fell swoop, 15 foreign fund managers. And we had a selection. We selected our companies. And it was like an NFL pool that we did it around. One of the companies was a meat company, and the manager came in and he said he maintained jobs. The company was bankrupt. He should have cut jobs. Then he would have salvaged the people that worked there. There is dislocation in these kind of situations. So we weren't able to save that company. We couldn't do anything with it. You know, we're talking about exports. What does this company really do? You know, before a lot of times they can serve the local economy. What did they do before? Serving local economy may generate enough income and jobs to support if you can maintain some little peace and stability for a little while and get these people situated. But again, it's looking at the essence of this business and not just creating jobs, creating a business. That succeeds, that creates opportunity. Mike, I did mention education. I said education takes 5, 10, 15 years. We don't have time for that in some instances. So you have to do something. You go back to what you have. What are the cards you're dealt? You can't say, oh, well, it's going to take all this time to do that, so we can't do this, we can't do that. You have to start someplace. And what I say, start with the little bit works. Doesn't work in every instance. What I said is Poland's not going to work in Poland. Poland's not going to work in Bulgaria, or Iraq. But what will work, based on these principles? How do we begin chipping away? General Schiarelli said, he talked about jobs because he said, for every 1,500 jobs are created, I need one less battalion to maintain order. Because then what happens is people are preoccupied with the jobs. They're wives are keeping them home because there was nothing worse than to be a widow in that society. So they keep their husbands working instead of planning the devices or working with the terrorists. So then you narrow down the bad apples. So you at least begin to chip away. And that's what we have to do in every one of these situations. What can we do to get the marginal difference?
Well, you know, quickly enough, the question about building trust, I think that is so key. And one of the things that happens in most of the conflict environments is that the trust goes more toward the voluntary organizations than they go toward national agencies or institutions that are considered to have one political agenda or the other that they seek to serve. And so for countries and also for institutions to learn how to work better with NGOs and community-based organizations is going to be key, and to find delivery mechanisms that you know these societies can depend on, because they consider the soft approach of these kinds of institutions that are not driven by other motivations that can create the distrust. So it's key for there to be this eclectic blending of the institutions that like you know the state institutions, the multilateral bodies, and the NGOs. That's going to be critical for building trust. In terms of the building the local capacity, that's also connected to the whole agenda of education. I think that a very dramatic way of actually improving the competencies around governance would be this identification of citizens that fled. It's such an important and a very great signal when three or four very strong citizens that fled as a result of the conflict can actually be brought back home to improve the massive scale up of competencies that happen. We've seen it happen in a place like Liberia, where a couple of the citizens that fled have actually left the United States and improved. We met and interacted with a couple of them when we did the travel to Liberia. That is so key a signal. They begin to shape the mind of what direction that society could be going, and then become a kind of magnet for several others who need to also vote with their feet in a journey toward home. So education is key. It would be remiss of me as a former minister of education not to consider education as the most critical thing for nation building. It is just that, you know, when you're talking about this post-conflict environment, I alluded to it when I said that the restoration of basic services is going to be key. And I consider health and education as a core component of the basic services that we need to see a restoration of. On the export-led growth question, I think that, you know, frankly speaking, it should be the story for all of Africa. Unfortunately, often when Africa is discussed, trade is never high on the agenda. And yet, countries have to trade in order to grow. And so the necessary institutions, as our friend from the university alluded to, the right policy frameworks, the right infrastructure, I mean, for every lack of access to power in Africa, at least 1.5% of GDP is lost. By the countries. So you see that infrastructure is key, reconstructing in order to providing them the fundamental base for identifying the sources of growth. One of the things I flagged when I was on the trip to China is that while you are going into Africa, bear in mind that you cannot call it a win-win situation between you and Africa if you're not linking enclave economies into which you're going to economies that can pull many people into job creating activities. And so local entrepreneurship can result out of, you know, mega projects that are being set up in the continent by having a linkage economy approach, so that you don't create dual economies. So export-led growth is very key and fundamental for all of Africa. Finally, on what you said about the prevention side of it, that was my last point, which is that even before conflict sets in, what are the things that need to be part of a society's cohesion? What are the shared values? What are the things that, you know, what are the equity issues? I mean, in the case of Kenya, for instance, it was the inequality that was growing and growing in a way that it then, once it got the opportunity to manifest, it just went that way. So getting that signal early enough and providing policy interventions and the kinds of conversation that would make an open approach to dealing with it possible is going to be key in arresting the possibilities of a breakdown. I think that having said this, I would leave it to His Royal Majesty the Ambassador to conclude.
Talk about eloquence. Brava. I am very glad, Shukrenya, Dajalia. Okay. I am very glad that many of you raised questions that we did not mention at all or did not develop fully enough. This tells me that there is a lot of enthusiasm about this particular issue and a lot of knowledge out there. And it also tells me that the U.S. Institute of Peace has a lot of work ahead of it. You must continue this momentum. I will just mention a few words about institutional development. It is critical for all societies, and especially societies in post-conflict scenarios or post-disaster scenarios, I would add. Some societies need much more work, much more help than others. Iraq, I would assess as being a country that does not really need a whole lot of external intervention to develop its, to redevelop and reestablish institutions that Iraq has had for many years, certainly since the end of World War I. Arguably, Iraq has had the strongest system of education in the entire Arab world until certainly Saddam Hussein or the 1990s. And a return to that kind of strong education in Iraq would be good not just for the state of Iraq, but also for the rest of the Arab world, I would argue. Afghanistan, on the other hand, is a nation, I believe, that will require outside help for a long time to come to establish institutions. I, like Mr. Ritter, have been involved with Afghanistan for about 30 years. I served at our embassy in the late 1970s, and essentially the situation has not really changed that much. And, of course, Afghanistan has gone through troughs and valleys for many years, and it's just now reemerging from a decade or more of very debilitating conflict. So it will require, I would argue, much more external intervention. The question remains, I will argue again, how much intervention. It is true, what kinds of intervention as well. We need to add that word what to the set of questions. I would say that among the great debilities that we as a government and other governments also manifest is the lack of capability in our institutions that are supposed to deliver this kind of institutional capacity development, whether it's in the Department of State, USAID, the Peace Corps, or other national institutions, Department of Agriculture, the Foreign Commercial Service, and so on, because we don't have the resources dedicated to the development of expertise. When I was in Afghanistan in the late 70s, USAID had senior officers who had decades and decades of experience in agricultural development, health development, educational development, and could contribute a lot to that nation. In the early 1990s in Niamey, in Niger, I was the number two at our embassy there. Again, USAID still had the elements of expertise in Sahelian agricultural development, education, and so on. Many of that expertise is gone, has been eliminated, has been whittled away by attrition or just not devotion of enough resources by the Office of Management and Budget, I would argue, and also by our Congress. So we need to build our own institutions in order to help other institutions in the correct way, not in some superficial way because somebody thinks they have a good idea for another nation because they went to school somewhere and they learned a little, they read a book about Afghanistan or Iraq. That is not enough. Finally, about trade, I completely agree with Obi that it applies not just to Africa, but it applies to the Arab world. The Arab world does not trade enough with itself. With the exception of Iraq and Jordan, the United Arab Emirates helps a little bit. But for the rest of it, there needs to be a greater amount of development of intra-Arab trade among these countries so that that export-led growth can help each other. It can lead to a synergy that will perhaps bring the Arab world out of the stasis that it has found itself in, as documented by the Human Development Project in the Arab world under the United Nations. Khalas.
Well, I'd like to thank the panel and inform you that, yes, we do realize that we have a lot of work ahead of us, but we are not fazed. We believe that we are going to continue investigating this matter. In a couple of months, we'll have a working group here at the USIP trying to investigate innovative solutions. Innovative don't need to be new. They're probably just better ways of doing things and a more decisive focus. Before I ask you to join me in thanking the panel, I'd like to recognize a dynamic trio who worked behind the scenes to make this happen, led by Catherine Morris, Sheila Mwandi, and Duke Lindsay is somewhere outside getting things done.
Thank you.
So I'd like you to join me one last time in thanking our very invigorative and informed panel. Thank you very much. And just one last thing. Next Wednesday, the Liberian finance minister will be here at 2 o'clock talking about Liberia's governance and economic management assistance program, a unique multi-donor experiment. I invite you to join us. Thank you very much.
Raymond,
great set of people.